This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Every so often we hear about breathtaking scientific breakthroughs. And this past year, there were several in the neurology world. The next speaker will describe one of those breakthroughs. Dr. Peter Kang is a pediatric neuromuscular neurologist and physician scientist at the University of Minnesota, where he is director of the Greg Martzoff Jr. Muscular Dystrophy Center and professor and vice chair of research for the Department of Neurology. His research focus on solving patient-related genetic and genomic puzzles in muscular dystrophy, along with a collaborative project to translate cell therapies for muscular dystrophy into human clinical trials. He is president of the Child Neurology Society, and Dr. Kang will update us on disease-modifying therapies for pediatric neuromuscular disorders.
Thank you, Dr. Takayama. So it's a really exciting time in the world of neuromuscular disorders in children. And one of the things that I find really heartening about the research and the developments is that not only are these therapies being approved specifically for children, but they're also being studied in children. And so it's really important for there to be a lot of focus on children, both in the research realm and the clinical realm. So I think this is good news for everybody, for our patients and for the healthcare providers who take care of children. So let me see if I can, I just need to advance my slide. There we go. These are my disclosures. So I'll go over diagnosis a bit and then therapies, but then spend a lot of the time going through cases. So let's talk about diagnosis. One of the biggest developments in diagnosis in recent years is the transformation of newborn screening from a panel that was largely focused on primarily metabolic disorders in childhood into more broad-based genetic disorders in childhood. So the big development in the past few years is the universal adoption now of spinal muscular atrophy newborn screening in all 50 states in the U.S. And the 50th state just signed on, I believe, within the past few months. So this is a new development. And that's very exciting because the first FDA-approved therapy for SMA was only approved in 2016. So it's really nice to see that in less than a decade now, we're screening all newborns for spinal muscular atrophy and are able, in most cases, to offer really exciting therapies. Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which is listed above here on the slide, is a little bit newer. And the first therapy for Duchenne muscular dystrophy was approved in 2016 also. However, it's been a bit more of a complicated situation, both technically with two-tier testing, as well as what the implications might be. So the recommended uniform screening panel still does not include DMD. However, there are three states now that have approved universal screening: Ohio, New York, and Minnesota. So we hope to see more states adopting this and for this to be adopted by RUSP so that that would encourage more widespread adoption. And then Pompe disease, genetic enzyme-based newborn screening has been on the RUSP, and over half of states include Pompe disease on their newborn screens. So we're seeing a broadening of newborn screening, and I expect that this trend will continue in future years. So let's talk about therapies a bit. If one were to stop at 2015 and then fast forward to today, it's amazing what's happened in the past decade. There are now seven therapies approved by the FDA for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and that doesn't include prednisone, which has been used off-label for many years and continues to be used for this. And the reason why it's used off-label is that it's a very old medication that's been around for decades. There are two corticosteroids now approved for Duchenne muscular dystrophy therapy. The most recent was just a few months ago. And then there are four antisense oligonucleotides, and they skip various exons in the pre-mRNA stage, and they alter the way the gene is transcribed and produces a more functional version of the gene dystrophin. And then there's gene therapy, which has been in the news a lot. There is a gene therapy now approved for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. It was just approved in 2023. And there are numerous therapies in human clinical trials. It's a scenario that was almost unimaginable 20 years ago when I began my career. So for spinal muscular atrophy, there are three therapies approved, as I mentioned. There's nusinersen, which is an antisense oligonucleotide that was the first one approved. It requires intrathecal dosing, meaning you have to do a lumbar puncture and administer it into the spinal fluid, and it requires repeated dosing. There's onasemnogene abeparvovec, which is an AAV9-based gene therapy. That was approved in 2019. It's administered intravenously. It can be given in a single dose. It does require significant pre- and post-treatment monitoring, and we'll see in one of the cases coming up what that really entails and why this should be done fairly carefully, even though on the surface it seems like it's a fairly straightforward treatment. And then there's risdiplam, which is a small molecule therapy approved in 2020, and that's oral, which is nice. It's the only one of the three that's orally dosed. It does also require ongoing dosing, however. Pompe disease is one of those classic metabolic neuromuscular diseases that's been known for a long time. There are currently two enzyme replacement therapies approved by the FDA, and they are similar in some ways to each other, but they have distinct differences. There's alglucosidase alpha, which was originally approved in 2006, and then a more recent enzyme replacement therapy, avoglucosidase alpha, and this is indicated specifically for late onset Pompe disease. So let's go into a few cases because this will illustrate how the landscape has changed and how there are now new dilemmas that we are all facing. So let's say you see a patient like this in your clinic, and this is from Duchenne's original publication back in the mid-19th century. And you can see that if you see a patient like this in your clinic, the thought of muscular dystrophy might immediately come to mind. And there are these two key findings in the diagram. One is the lumbar lordosis, and the other is the calf pseudohypertrophy. And for anyone in the audience who has seen these patients, these are distinct physical findings that are true today as well as in the mid-19th century. The other classic physical exam finding that you'd see in children like this would be the Gower sign, where the child makes a triangle and then walks up his or her legs. In Duchenne, it would be a boy in most cases, and in other forms of muscular dystrophy, it could be a boy or girl, walks up their legs to get up to a standing position. So for diagnostic testing, the serum CK level is still a really important test to send. It's been around since the mid-20th century. It can be sent very easily from most diagnostic labs, and it's still extremely useful. However, it does have some ambiguities, especially if it's only mildly elevated. And I know a lot of us have experienced this in our practices where we see a patient, we're not really sure if there's a neuromuscular disorder going on and the CK is say 300 or so. And that's always tricky. In Duchenne muscular dystrophy, it's typically not ambiguous. The CK level is typically above 1,000, and it can be 50 or 100,000. And the upper limit of normal hovers around 200 in most diagnostic labs. Now, genetic testing has become much more a frontline test for all forms of muscular dystrophy. For Duchenne in particular, 2/3 of cases are associated with deletions and duplications of one or more exons, and then 1/3 of cases are associated with smaller mutations. Single nucleotide variants is one kind, and then small insertions and deletions. So the genetic testing has become much more accessible, much more sophisticated, and it has become an indispensable tool for diagnosing these cases. However, the thing that is troubling about diagnosis, and this is something that is really sobering, is that when we look at the data over the past few decades, the age of diagnosis really hasn't changed for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And you would think with the widespread availability of genetic testing, the greater knowledge and the new therapies, that it would come to mind more rapidly. But the average age of diagnosis is still 5 years of age. And that's unfortunate because there's a narrow window right now when the gene therapy is available to affected boys for Duchenne. So this is a problem. This is one of the reasons why it is important to think more carefully about newborn screening and why certain states have started to adopt it and why we hope that more will in the future. So if this happens not to be Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and I don't want to digress too much, but there are numerous forms of muscular dystrophy that are not Duchenne, and they can affect boys and girls. And unfortunately, there is this conception sometimes that it's primarily boys that get muscular dystrophy. It's actually not true. There are many females who also get muscular dystrophy. So having a female patient in your clinic shouldn't put muscular dystrophy out of mind as a consideration. It definitely occurs, and more often than I think sometimes we realize. So there are now dozens of genetic subtypes of muscular dystrophy that have been described, and this diagram shows you where some of the protein products operate. And the line across the middle shows the sarcolemma, which is the muscle fiber membrane. The top section of the diagram is the extracellular matrix, and then the bottom part is the inside of the muscle fiber. And you can see that proteins involved in muscular dystrophy are scattered throughout the muscle fiber and are sometimes outside the muscle fiber. And they create a complex architecture, which unfortunately is fairly fragile when you have a mutation in one of the encoding genes. So genetic testing panels for neuromuscular disorders now include over 100 genes. There is a lot of phenotypic overlap, meaning the clinical features can overlap among many of these genes. And the phenotype clues can help us interpret ambiguous or conflicting results. So physical exam is still very important. I do exams in clinic all the time, and I get valuable clues from them, despite all the really sophisticated diagnostic technology available now. Serum CK levels, as I mentioned, are valuable. Sometimes we still do muscle biopsies. And so even though muscle biopsies are not done as often in these children, sometimes you really are stuck with a difficult situation diagnostically, and it can be very useful in helping to resolve the matter. I think a lot of us who have been involved in sending genetic testing from our clinics have encountered these variants of unknown significance, and that really is quite frustrating. And I know that there are various research efforts around the country to try to find a better resolution to these, because when you see this on a genetic test report, it really leads to a lot of frustration and uncertainty. And sometimes you can find variants in more than one gene that also causes confusion. So let's get back to Duchenne muscular dystrophy. We had a little bit of a digression to other types of muscular dystrophy, and I won't go into those in detail due to the time constraints. And Duchenne is the most likely form that you would be seeing in your clinic. So there are three corticosteroids that are used now. The prednisone and deflazacort have been used for a long time, and vamorolone was just approved. And so now there are three types. They have different side effect profiles, so every patient's a little different. There's no one that's clearly the best corticosteroid at this time. I think it's important to think about what the patient's situation is like and the side effect profiles and what might be the best fit. So for antisense oligonucleotides, also known as exon skipping compounds, there are four approved by the FDA. And the dystrophin gene is really large and has 79 exons. And so there are various hotspot areas where you tend to have a lot of mutations. And by skipping some of these exons at the pre-mRNA stage, you can generate transcripts that are more intact. They'll be shorter than the ones that were originally encoded for, of course, but they'd be more functional and more stable than the ones that would be generated otherwise. And so these are important to consider in children who have Duchenne muscular dystrophy. The one caveat to keep in mind in terms of administration is these are only administered intravenously, and they have to be administered regularly on an indefinite basis. So that is a conversation that's important to have with a family. Are they able to bring their child in or arrange home infusions for an extended period of time without a clear endpoint? And so that's one thing that should be a thoughtful discussion with patients and their families. Gene therapy is a really exciting field right now. And there are many vehicles that exist. There are plasmid delivery systems, retroviruses, lentiviruses, adenoviruses, adeno-associated viruses. If you look at all in the literature, you'll see that there are all kinds of packages or vehicles where you can put genes or parts of genes to deliver into a patient that has a deficiency of one of these. All of these vehicles have strengths and limitations. Like with anything else, there's no perfect vehicle. Currently, the most popular virus or popular vehicle for gene therapy is what's called adeno-associated virus, or AAV. And you probably have seen AAV mentioned a lot. It is classified as a parvovirus in the virology world. The reason why it's called adeno-associated virus is that it was discovered as a contaminant in adenovirus preparations, and it requires help for replication. That's actually one of the reasons why it's such a useful gene therapy vehicle, is that it's not able to replicate easily on its own, especially in the recombinant forms, and thus concerns about it propagating without control or spinning out of control with replication are really minimal concerns with this kind of virus. And so, and once you have the recombinant forms, they even lack the elements that they had before for replication in a host cell. So that makes it much safer than certain other viruses. And several AAV-based gene therapies are now approved by the FDA, including the one that I mentioned just recently for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So going back to our case again, we're still on case one. We have a patient with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. The gene therapy was approved. It requires a single intravenous infusion. Is our patient eligible for this therapy? One factor right now is that it depends on the age. And then we also want to think about side effects. So gene therapy is not always benign. And so we have to be careful about thinking about potential toxicities, both in a research setting and even in the clinical setting. Even if a gene therapy has been approved by the FDA, it requires a lot of careful monitoring to administer safely. Some of the side effects can include nausea and vomiting, which is unpleasant, but resolves. Hepatotoxicity, which can be quite serious. Immune reactions to the AAV vector, which can also be serious. And then thrombocytopenia. So there are some fairly serious toxicities that can occur after administration of the AAV gene therapy. So gene therapy for Duchenne muscular dystrophy is currently restricted to ages 4 and 5 years. So it's a fairly narrow window. And as we discussed a few slides ago, the average age of diagnosis is still around 5 years. That means a lot of boys with Duchenne muscular dystrophy don't get diagnosed till they're past this window. And so because this approval is relatively recent, the implications are still being digested by many. But the rationale for doing newborn screening is becoming more clear for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Monitoring is really important. The AAV-mediated gene therapy carries the risk of hepatotoxicity, but ALT and AST are often elevated in DMD patients. So for those of us who see DMD patients in our clinic, if we check a regular comprehensive metabolic panel, the ALT and AST are often elevated. And that's not due to hepatotoxicity at baseline or hepatic dysfunction, but it's really due to AST and ALT being present in small amounts in skeletal muscle. But when you get an ALT and AST level, you can't tell. And so if you administer AAV and these transaminases are elevated at baseline, what do you do? So that gets into some technical details, which we can discuss another time. But there are ways to try to distinguish whether the ALT and AST elevations are different, whether they're more coming from the liver versus the skeletal muscle. And so it requires some careful monitoring. And then immune reactions and thrombocytopenia are also concerns. Gene therapies are deceptively simple to administer. As I mentioned, it's only a single intravenous infusion. However, there is a lot of monitoring required both before and after therapy, and the side effects can be significant. So in general, gene therapy should only be administered in centers that are fully equipped to handle multi-organ system complications. And the goal is to screen potential recipients carefully so that these gene therapies may be administered as safely as possible. So let's move on to case two. Case two is an adult male who had prenatal genetic screening. And I bring this up in a pediatric setting because this, as we do start doing newborn screening more for Duchenne dystrophy, this kind of scenario may start coming up depending on the technology that's used. This adult has normal muscle strength and a normal serum CK level, and then had an in-frame duplication detected in dystrophin. And the question came up genetically, is the duplication in tandem? And this is a research study that was done in my lab. Nanopore sequencing is a technology that we are using pretty frequently in my lab. And we confirmed that this duplication was in fact in tandem, meaning that the two copies of this section of dystrophin were right next to each other, indicating that this is a benign variant. What this suggests is that as we start doing more asymptomatic screening, prenatal screening, newborn screening, and depending on when the genetic testing comes into play, we will likely be detecting more and more benign variants, and we'll have to be ready for how to interpret those. And this is just a diagram from a recent publication indicating how we determined that this duplication was in tandem. So current newborn screening methodology relies on a two-tier system. You take the dried blood spots from the newborn screen, you check the creatine kinase level, and then those who have significantly elevated levels then go on for genetic testing. So the individual in question would not have been detected on this current process of newborn screening, but if we contemplate a future when exome sequencing or genome sequencing is done on a routine basis in newborns, these types of variants will be picked up, and then we do have to figure out how will we interpret them, how do we figure out whether they're benign or not in a clinical setting. So let's move on to case three. You receive a call from your state's Department of Health. You're in your practice right now and in your clinic. A newborn that you accepted into your practice but have not seen yet is tested positive for SMA on newborn screening. So you are referring immediately to the nearest comprehensive neuromuscular clinic, and you also add this patient onto your schedule for the next day. It's important to remember physical examination may be normal or pretty close to normal in most cases. Some neonates do present with varying degrees of hypotonia and weakness, and others might have normal neurological examinations. For those of us who have seen these newborn screening results in our practices, sometimes they're accompanied by information about SMN2 copy number, and that's a similar gene that's on the same chromosome as SMN1, and SMN1 is the main driver of the disease status. But the second form of the gene, SMN2, can alleviate some of those manifestations. So it helps knowing the copy number of SMN2 can help you determine prognosis, but it's not perfect, and it's not something we should rely on in isolation. So as a lot of us have seen in our practices, SMN1 deletions are the main type of genetic variant associated with SMA. And then the copy numbers of SMN2 vary due to recombination events, and it tends to be fairly unstable. Usually you just have two copies of every gene. In SMN2, this is an exception because the copy number can vary a fair bit. And the fewer copies one has in the setting of SMN1 deletion, the more severe the disease is likely to be. But the correlation is not precise due to a variety of other factors. So the patient in question turns out to have four copies of SMN2. So four is twice the number that you typically have. And so you'd think that this would be a relatively mild case, but that's not always true. So if you see this table from a paper from just last year, that SMA3, which is one of the milder forms of it, is most closely tied with having four copies. However, four or more copies. However, you do see a few instances of the more severe cases, SMA1 and SMA2. So that is a cautionary note. So in the clinic, this infant with spinal muscular atrophy was found to have mild signs of hypotonia. And the parents are presented with three FDA-approved options, and they're here on the table from a recent publication from us. And I mentioned this before, there's the nusinersen, which is intrathecal, the gene therapy in the middle, and then the risdiplam, which is the oral therapy on the right-hand side. So after some deliberation and discussion, the family decided they wanted to proceed with gene therapy. We did some preliminary lab work. Insurance approval, as some of us may have encountered seeing these patients in our clinic, Can sometimes be a hurdle. The gene therapy is costly. It's $2.1 million. And so there is sometimes some questions, as you can imagine, from the insurance company about this. And so there's a lot of paperwork that needs to be submitted, including genetic test results, a lot of this preliminary laboratory work. So in this case, the insurance company denied the authorization due to the four copy numbers of SMN2. However, we really felt that the infant was at risk. The infant already seemed to be having some symptoms, which is a bit concerning. So after a little bit of back and forth, we received insurance approval and the infant received gene therapy at 4 months. So this is what happened after the infusion. So the ALT and AST were pretty normal in the pre-infusion stage. Remember, this is spinal muscular atrophy. So normally the ALT and AST are in normal limits. But you can see by 6 weeks, there is a really tremendous spike in the GGT peaked at 1,345. So this was a delayed immune reaction that can be quite scary. And this is an illustration of why post-treatment monitoring is really, really important in gene therapy. You do not want to lose sight of these patients for quite a while after they receive it. So we had to, the standard protocol does involve steroids. We had to go up on the steroids. We had to admit this patient to the hospital and switch to IV for a little while. And subsequently, his LFTs normalized and he's been doing quite well and his motor development has been really excellent. So that it all ended well. And this illustrates how important the monitoring is. So in the interest of time, I'll move on to case four now. So in case four, you receive another call from your state's Department of Health. There's another newborn, and this one's screened positive for Pompe disease. And so you do the same thing. You refer the patient to the nearest neuromuscular clinic and add them on for an urgent visit. And what do you see on physical exam? You can see a normal exam. This patient may look totally normal in your clinic, this infant. But you might see some of the signs of Pompe disease, including macroglossia, enlarged tongue, hepatosplenomegaly, hypotonia, and muscle weakness. And this is a situation where doing a good physical exam is really important. So there are two general forms of Pompe disease recognized in infancy, infantile onset and late onset. And you can see that there's a lot of manifestations of the infantile onset. It's usually not subtle. And in most cases, you can easily distinguish between the two. Although, of course, there are some ambiguous cases that give you a little bit of trouble in terms of classification. So there are lots of questions that come up in these newborn screen patients. If the infant has infantile onset Pompe disease, you want to move ahead with enzyme replacement therapy as soon as possible. If the patient has late onset Pompe disease and looks pretty good, then it's a little bit trickier, and the enzyme replacement therapy does require frequent intravenous infusions. So you do want to think about whether you want to treat immediately or not, and this entails a significant discussion with the family. And this is just a paper that we recently published where we determined how one might predict infantile onset versus late onset, depending on the type of mutation you have in the gene. So this is something that becomes tricky, especially if it's not an infantile onset case in terms of what you'll do. And this involves careful discussions with the family, with the subspecialists, and everybody coming to a consensus ideally on what the best plan is for the child. And case five, I'll just discuss briefly, is an adolescent male who presents at 16 years. He presents with this unusual presentation of full body paralysis that can last for hours. This started at 3 years and it's been getting worse. And there are numerous triggers that he's identified, including carbohydrate-rich foods. He was diagnosed with hypokalemic periodic paralysis. This is a dominant disorder, and there are other family members affected. The first line therapy is some oral potassium supplementation. There are other the medications that involve alterations in ion shifts that he's tried. And we tried some of the traditional ones. None are specifically approved by the FDA for this diagnosis among these older ones. So we moved on to diclofenamide, which was approved in 2015 after he failed some of the older therapies. And this was added to his current regimen, and he had a really good response. And so this is something that we found to be really heartening, and it made a difference in his quality of life. So let's move on to the summary. Newborn screening is really helpful for diagnosing several pediatric neuromuscular disorders, and I envision newborn screening will only expand in the future. The panels still differ from state to state. It will be nice in the future if we were to converge upon more common panels in the future, but that's still something that will take some time. It is important to recognize symptoms and signs of neuromuscular disorders in childhood. Newborn screening will definitely not pick up everything. There are some really thrilling new developments in the therapeutic realm. Several therapies have been improved over the past decade, which really are transforming care for these patients. It is important to weigh risks and benefits of therapies when counseling families about their options. So I'd like to end and want to thank colleagues at our Muscular Dystrophy Center and my laboratory, whose work I presented in part, and some of the funders who've helped us. And I'll be happy to take questions for this next segment. Thank you.
So Peter, thank you so much for opening a window to the newest therapies used to help children, youth, and adults with neuromuscular disabilities. I was actually trying to sort of understand more about the gene therapy aspect and wanted to just review this to make sure I had this right. Would that be okay?
Of course.
Okay. So people with Duchenne muscular dystrophy have a progressive muscle weakness, and that's because of a muscle protein that doesn't work. And that's because the gene that's responsible for its production is dysfunctional. And I guess that's what we call the dysfunctional dystrophin gene. And in gene therapy, you actually modify a dystrophin gene that is functional. You package it into a virus, and the virus gets injected, and the injected virus infects the human cell, but in a good way. And the human cells, by that I mean the muscles, and places the gene in a safe part of the human cell. So the new gene doesn't become part of the human DNA, but it still remains on the side. But then they do start to produce a more functional protein. And so therefore, you basically delay the muscle weakness from happening. Does that sound reasonable?
That's perfect. Yeah, I think, and I'll just emphasize a couple of points you raised, which I unfortunately had to gloss over a little bit in the main presentation. But the dystrophin gene is gigantic, and the AAV virus is unfortunately kind of small. The smallness is good because it's less immunogenic, but it means you can only put so much DNA in it. And so over the years, various scientists have been testing different truncated forms of this gene. And there are several that are used in these different AAV therapies, and one has been approved now, and there are others in clinical trials. And so we've identified the most functional segments of dystrophin. So we deliver just a small part of the gene, but it's what we believe are the most important parts. The one thing about AAV that's very helpful, as you mentioned, is that whatever the payload they deliver does not integrate into the human genome. So there's a big concern about gene therapy is that if the DNA you're delivering integrates into the human genome and accidentally activates an oncogene or disrupts a gene that is necessary for normal function, it could actually end up doing more harm than good. So one of the reasons why AAV is so popular currently as a gene therapy vehicle is that the payload is deposited in the cell, but it doesn't integrate into the human genome. So that's a really big plus about it.
Ah, and so then my question is, does this mean that Duchenne's can be cured?
So the word cure has been a really interesting word that's been discussed in the rare disease community, at least, you know, my window into the rare disease community. And as we all know, since we all treat pediatric patients, a lot of pediatric diseases are rare. So the definition of a cure, I think the... What patients have been telling me and patient advocacy groups have been saying is that sometimes having the word cure as a short-term goal creates some barriers, because then the bar is so high that that treatments that may provide substantial benefit but wouldn't necessarily be defined as a cure would then be bypassed. And so cure is something that ultimately we'd like to get to. And some patients define cure as, it's interesting when you talk to patients, sometimes they will define cure as just having some stability in their clinical course and not having to worry constantly about decline that's happening in the future. That's one of the things that at least some patients have told me is it's what really bothers them is that thought of the anticipated progression. So with gene therapy, you know, we don't have a lot of long-term data on Duchenne. We don't even have a lot of long-term data on SMA, which was approved a little bit earlier, just because they're still so recent. So we don't know what these patients will look like 20 years from now. It'd be nice if they were completely healthy and didn't require any further therapies. We don't know that yet. And so that's something that that will require a lot of careful study in the future. And I think we should look at what's feasible in terms of next steps. Stabilizing is a good initial goal. And then once we've reached stabilization, can we improve the patient's status after that?
Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. And so I'm going through some of the Q&As. And so one is, does Medicaid, so the public health insurance, pay for $1 million plus gene therapy?
In a lot of states, Medicaid will. I don't know that I can say that every state does. And and every state, every Medicaid program, I think, has different criteria, as well as other third-party payers. There's, you know, the SMN2 copy number, their laboratory studies, what the patient looks like. There are these physical functional outcome measures, like the CHOP-INTEND score. For anyone who's seen these patients, you may have heard of this. It's a functional motor outcome scale where you check different things on the baby. Typically a physical therapist checks these and then comes up with a numerical score. And that can also influence what a Medicaid or another third party payer will do. I think the payment is significant. And as you can imagine, the significant amount paid for one of these gene therapies could go towards, you know, many doses of another therapy. So that does bring up some ethical questions. I think we're still working through how do we weigh the benefits versus the costs? And what does that mean for society as a whole? Because as more of these therapies get improved, the aggregate cost does become more substantial. And we have to figure out what's most beneficial for as many patients as possible.
So the cost can actually go up. Okay. And I suspect that part of that also has to do with the cost of the research and all the testing that's associated with the medication or the therapy.
So the research and development, the R&D part, is a significant component of the cost. The manufacturing of the gene therapy is a significant ongoing cost. So, you know, I think it might be feasible in the future for the cost to drop a bit. I think one of the big factors that can help drive that would be to lower manufacturing costs. Generating many, many doses of this tiny virus and in a way that there's no contamination and it's safe for human administration is a fairly arduous process. And that's one of the bottlenecks, both on the research side and the clinical side, is the intensity and the cost of the manufacturing. So I think that's one of the big factors that could, in the future, drive down the cost, is if the manufacturing becomes more streamlined.
Thank you. So the last question, and this is more about thinking about the future. Which is, what do you predict for neuromuscular diseases in the next half century or so?
In the next half century, I would anticipate most babies, if not all, will be getting some form of genetic testing at birth, and probably with widespread preconceptional testing. Now, you know, costs will have to drop, and we'll need a way to either find a way to interpret this better or automate the process of interpretation. But on the diagnostic side, in 50 years, I fully expect that will be what's happening. In terms of therapies, these AAV therapies will become be pretty routine and may even be supplanted by a newer technology. You never know. There are stem cell therapies being developed. There's all kinds of oligonucleotides. So I think the future is very exciting. There are obviously lots of challenges, but really the past decade has been amazing to watch and to participate in.
Wow. Well, more to come, but thank you so very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.